Let us pray. Father in heaven, we give thee thanks for this day and for this hour. And we rejoice in our salvation, which is the gift of thy love. We praise thee, O Lord, for the gift of minds and hearts and wills. And we pray thee to quicken us in thy service, that we may be worthy of the high calling that is ours in Christ Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. In the summer of 1964, H. Eugene McLeod became a student at the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. This was a dramatic step in his life. Already he had graduated from Clemson University and from Iowa State University. He had received the B.S. degree from Clemson and the M.S. and Ph.D. degrees from Iowa State. When he entered this seminary in the summer of 1964, Dr. McLeod had already attained distinction in his field of agricultural engineering. He had served at that time for 2 years as a full professor of engineering in Ohio State University. We were very glad indeed that he came to us, venturing upon a career in theological education. Dr. McLeod had been a distinguished student before he came to us. He was the author or co-author of technical papers in his field. He had been elected to Sigma Xi and Gamma Sigma Delta, honorary scientific fraternities. And having come to us, he proved to be an excellent student. Upon his graduation from this seminary with a BD degree in 1967, he was elected librarian and assistant professor of bibliography. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I present to you for his inaugural address, Dr. H. Eugene McLeod.
Dean Brown, and fellow members and friends of the seminary community. I am profoundly thankful for the opportunity which is mine for service in this community of faith and learning, and for the privilege of speaking to you today. Dr. Raymond P. Morris, now nearing the end of a long and brilliant tenure as librarian of the Yale Divinity School and as outstanding leader and interpreter of theological librarianship, wrote in the first issue of the journal Theological Education in 1964, "Few things shape the quality and style of an educational program more than its library. To no small degree, the library determines the faculty an institution attracts and retains, the quality of instruction it provides, the character of the student body it recruits, and the kind of product the school produces. Indeed, few indices point more accurately to the health of an educational institution than its attitudes toward its library and the sacrifices it is willing to make for it. If the institution has integrity, it gives primary consideration to this matter." End of quotation. As a new librarian reading a statement like that, I am tempted to an exaggerated view of my own importance. But I am immediately humbled by a conditioned response growing out of 11 years involvement in teaching and research in educational institutions. I know the real score. If that were not enough, I am further humbled by these words from Dr. Morris. Carlyle's affirmation, "The true university is a collection of books," like the adage, "The library is the heart of the institution," may be tempered by Emerson's quip, "It is not observed that librarians are wiser than others." Seriously now, I believe what Dr. Morris said about the importance of the library to an educational institution. It is true. And as the one bearing primary responsibility for something so important to this institution, I am humbled by that truth. But like all relative truth, it is dangerous only when held exclusively, when elevated to the place of ultimate truth. In this case, when the truth of the shaping, determinative effects of the library is balanced by the truth that few things shape the quality and style of an educational program more than its faculty, then a healthier, more creative condition exists. I am still humbled, but now I also am somewhat relieved and have new hope. For I am reminded that the library and I do not bear the full responsibility for the educational program, and that indeed the faculty has a great deal to do with the success of the library. I am given further hope by adding another balancing truth, that the administration also has an extremely significant role in determining the total quality of the educational institution. I will forego similar discussion of the truth contained in Emerson's quip regarding the wisdom of librarians. I cannot imagine anyone challenging his position then, and I am certain that no librarian in his right mind would do so now. My purpose today is to share with you some of my thinking about our library's development, about its past development for perspective and appreciation, but primarily about an approach to its future development. My remarks are addressed to you as persons also concerned about the future of this seminary and its library. Southeastern Seminary opened its first academic session in September 1951, occupying the present Appleby Building, which was to be its home until Wake Forest College vacated the remainder of the campus in 1956. President S.L. Staley, three full-time professors, one of whom was Dr. Leo Green, and two part-time professors entered into an exciting new educational venture together with 102 students. One of the part-time professors was the controller, Joseph R. Robinson, who also served as librarian. Space for the library was provided in one of the classrooms in the Appleby Building, and the task of assembling a basic theological book collection was begun. In slightly more than 1 year, approximately 8,000 books were acquired and on hand to greet Edwin C. Osborne, the man who would catalog them. On November 10, 1952, he began that mammoth cataloging operation. As you might imagine, many of these books were acquired through the generosity of friends of the seminary and of other libraries. I find it interesting to compare this rather rapid accumulation of books with the beginnings of the oldest library and perhaps the greatest academic library in this country. Harvard College was founded in 1636 and bears the name of the man who 2 years later enabled the college to begin a library and its function. The young Puritan minister John Harvard bequeathed 780 pounds, half of his estate, and 260 books to the school. 85 years later, in 1723, the Harvard Library's first printed catalog listed only 3,517 volumes, with nearly 60% of these in theological fields. Today's librarian, faced with a virtual flood of published materials, could hardly be blamed for a bit of wishful thinking about such a pace of acquisition. The preceding account is not entirely a digression, for I want to briefly place the development of our library in the context of the history of theological education and theological libraries. As you know, the early development of American institutions of higher education was vitally related to theological education. Yale, as well as Harvard, furnishes a good example of the centrality of the library in the establishment of a college with a primary concern for theological education. The founding of Yale in 1701 grew out of a meeting of ministers to which each man brought a cherished book from his own collection, thus forming the nucleus of the Yale College Library. The early setting of theological education in America was then in the colleges, where from the beginning, in the words of Encyclopedia Britannica, the need for libraries as the central part of institutions of learning has been recognized. End quotation. During the turbulent 18th century, theological education to a great extent moved from the colleges through a stage of tutorial or apprentice training under experienced ministers and into the beginning of the period of seminary education. In 1934, the Institute of Social and Religious Research published its influential four-volume study, The Education of American Ministers, a chapter entitled The Libraries of Theological Seminaries, and based on a detailed study of 36 schools, including many of the strongest, presents a rather bleak picture. Theological libraries, quote, have not as a group participated in the very rapid development of the public and university libraries. And these, considered in this study, are as a group improperly and inadequately staffed to carry on a successful type of library service. End of quotation. But a better day was dawning. What was to become in 1938 the American Association of Theological Schools had been functioning since 1918 as the Conference of Theological Seminaries and Colleges in the United States and Canada, with growing concern for standards of quality for theological education. A commission on accrediting was established in 1936, and its first report contained a short statement on libraries. Slowly but surely, the role of the library in theological education was coming to be understood. The association in 1946 and 1947 fostered the American Theological Library Association, which was to become a vital force in library development. Southeastern Seminary was thus born at a time when considerable pressure was mounting upon theological schools to give adequate attention to their libraries. New American Association of Theological Schools, AATS, accrediting standards issued in 1954 included a greatly expanded and detailed section on the library. The entire theological education enterprise was beginning an intensive self-study at this time, guided by a staff under the direction of H. Richard Niebuhr. In such a setting, and with a faculty committed to quality education for ministry, the seminary library grew rapidly. Two moves to larger quarters were made within Appleby Building, the last one to occupy both the present small chapel and Bethea Room. With the move of Wake Forest College in 1956, the way was cleared for demolishing a condemned part of their library building, the rear wing being remodeled and joined with a new three-story structure begun by the seminary in 1957. The present building was occupied in the spring of 1958, enabling the library to greatly expand its services to a student body now numbering around 700. Evidence of the healthy growth of the seminary, including its library, came in the form of accreditation by AATS in June of 1958. The ATLA library program, library development program, should be mentioned for the major contribution it made to our library and to these other libraries in the AATS. Southeastern Seminary participated for 3 years in this program between 1963 and 1966, matching dollar for dollar the maximum grant available to greatly increase the money allocated for purchasing books and periodicals. In addition to the immediate benefit, the book budget was sustained at the new level, from which it has continued to increase. Included in the program was an extremely helpful visit and study of our library in 1963 by Dr. Raymond P. Morris, who was then serving as chairman of the ATLA Library Development Program. The retirement of librarian Edwin C. Osborne on July 31, 1967, ended a period of service extending back almost 15 years to the beginning of the seminary's second academic year. Appointed cataloger on November 1, 1952, he became librarian in June 1953, but continued to carry the heavy cataloging load. This dual role was his through the years, though he had major administrative assistance from 1959 to 1964 and professional cataloging assistance from 1964 to 1966. Most of the 74,367 cataloged books and pamphlets in the collection at his retirement had been personally described and classified by him. Aided by a dedicated faculty, diligent in the work of book selection, a collection had been formed which, though to be sure it had weaknesses, was rather remarkable in size and quality for so young a school. Edwin C. Osborne deserves our lasting gratitude for valuable and sacrificial service in the early development of the seminary library. Two problems of immediate importance faced the librarian-elect in the spring of 1967. Preparation of a capital funds request for building improvements and recruitment of a qualified catalog librarian. Recognizing serious functional deficiencies in the present library building, as well as the approaching need for increased shelf space, it seemed important to take advantage of the once in 5 years opportunity to request capital funds from the Southern Baptist Convention. President Binkley wisely authorized the securing of expert counsel in determining our needs. Thus, his request was carefully documented by the report of two outstanding library planning consultants. After careful investigation, the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention included in its recommended capital needs program the amount of $650,000 for major modification of our present library building. Convention approval came in 1968, with funds to be made available probably in 1971. This action was of singular importance to the ongoing development of the Southeastern Seminary Library. The second immediate problem proved to be a tough one. Catalogers are by far the scarcest variety of generally scarce librarians. One well qualified for a theological library is a genuine rarity. An exceptionally fortunate conclusion to a long search was reached on October 1, 1968, when Miss Betty Ann Smith became catalog librarian. She brings to this position valuable experience, dedication to theological librarianship, and a high level of professional competence. One other recent change of major proportions should be noted. With several years remaining before building modification could begin, it seemed wise to consider ways to improve service despite deficiencies in the present building layout. A major rearrangement of facilities and resources was undertaken in the summer of 1968, directed toward more effective bibliographic and reference service, consolidation of some related materials and facilities, and toward increasing both the total useful study space and the proximity of study spaces to books and journals. During my brief period as librarian and a member of this faculty, I have come increasingly to appreciate the value of several assets for which I want to publicly express gratitude. I make these rather personal references because, in even the short time that I have had for shop talk with theological librarians, it has become apparent that some of these assets are all too frequently absent from theological library situations. One asset is an official document of this school entitled Office of Librarian, which describes the position and its official relationships in excellent terms, which are clear, without restricting responsible freedom and creativity. Another is a president to whom the library is responsible, the librarian is responsible, who is an educator, who places high value on the library, and who proves his concern for the library with continuous support and encouragement. Then there is the faculty, which accepts me as a colleague, takes a healthy interest in the development of the library, and offers friendly counsel. Another asset frequently missing is a business manager who understands and appreciates the educational function of the institution, patiently seeks to understand problems peculiar to the operation of a library, and works hard to help find workable solutions. Last, but by no means least, is the dedicated and effective service of a library staff, which exhibits remarkable teamwork and concern for the total well-being and development of the library. And this is by no means an exhaustive list of the assets which I find here. Now let us turn our attention to the future. One cannot think from an involved point of view for long about the future of a theological library without being impressed with the increasing complexities derived from the state of ferment in the world of theological education and the explosion of both information and technology in the world of libraries. These are indeed days of great uncertainty in general, and such thoughts tempt a speaker to tick off a lengthy list of revolutions or other symptoms of a too swiftly changing world. I will all but resist that temptation, but I must observe that there is little left for a man to depend upon. VASA, that ultimate symbol of the Woman's College, has just admitted 80 male students. And if that's not bad enough, on January 1 of this year, the Boy Scouts began admitting girls to Exploring, its character building program for boys from 14 to 18. Complexities and rapid change are not likely to diminish. In their midst, we must seek to chart the best course possible for our library. And we dare not chart one, for to drift aimlessly, to just grow, is to court mediocrity and to risk irrelevance. I wish shortly to suggest some things which seem to me to be important to the orderly growth and development of the library in the future which is emerging right this moment. First, I think I should mention some presuppositions or convictions which are basic to all that I say. The First is that theological education is required by the implicit demand of the faith affirmation Jesus Christ is Lord to be understood to some degree in order for meaningful commitment and service to result. Theological education is basically involved with seeking to understand the full meaning of that affirmation for the total life of man, a process which leads naturally to the study of the origins, content, and history of the Christian faith, of its relationships to all of man's thought and experiences, of its imperatives for ministry, and of its actual and possible forms of ministry. Theological education, at least in part, needs to bring competent, committed teachers and students together in the context of community for a free encounter with the primary documents of our Christian heritage, with the scholars of past and present whose efforts at understanding have been recorded, and with the means for understanding the contemporary world. The library is essentially involved in making possible these encounters through which theological education occurs. Theological education, by its very nature, is worthy of no less than the best efforts of all who are involved. True excellence should be the goal. The Middle States Association, a regional accrediting agency for institutions of higher education, has said, and I quote, "An institution of higher education never arrives. It is always on the way to greater excellence." I believe that this is a valid statement, and I like to think that it is characteristic of our seminary. So my conception of our efforts toward the growth and development of the library is symbolized by the phrase, "the pursuit of excellence," a concept reflected by my choice of a title for this address, "The Seminary, Library, and the Pursuit of Excellence." The most fundamental effort in the pursuit of excellence for our library is to design a library program to uniquely fit this school, which we realistically expect to become, the school which we realistically expect to become. By library program is meant a plan for the total system of persons, subject matter resources, activities, physical facilities, equipment, and financial resources involved in providing library service. These components are obviously interrelated in ways which demand consideration, both in long-range planning and in the daily process of decision-making. For example, in the design of a building, some things must be known or assumed about the activities to be connected with it. Once constructed, the building becomes to some degree a determining factor in the selection and performance of activities, perhaps not only directly, but indirectly through, for example, the quality of its provision generally for the needs of the staff. In every library, these components are present, related in more or less of a system, and produce some kind of library service. In every library which merits the rating of overall excellence, these components are formed and related in an efficient, effective system according to a plan, the library program, carefully devised in accord with specific objectives for library service. It should be apparent that differences in programs and characteristics among academic institutions, indeed among theological schools, call forth different programs of library service. The library standards of the AATS recognize this fact in the opening sentence. The library program of an accredited theological school or cluster should be thoroughly integrated with the educational objectives, end quotation. The point is made more forcefully in the context of the pursuit of excellence in another statement by the Middle States Association. The primary characteristic for a good academic library is its complete identification with its own institution. The measure of its excellence is the extent to which its resources and services support the institution's objectives. End of quotation. Academic institutions which grow strong with the passing years do so, I believe, partly because they continually engage in a process of self-study and evaluation, which results in clarification of purposes and more sharply delineating specific measurable objectives. They have a vision of where they are going, of what kind of school they are becoming. It is a sign of the health of our seminary that the Board of Trustees has authorized a self-study of all phases of the life and work of the school, acting upon the recommendation of the president with the concurrence of the faculty. This is particularly timely for the library, where the need to design a library program such as we have been discussing has become crucially important in view of the opportunity we have to plan a library building. The greater the precision with which we are able to predict the characteristics of the seminary in the years ahead, the better the building will serve to make possible an excellent library. This difficult task deserves the best efforts of the faculty and administration. Regardless of the precise shape of the future, anticipated or actual, assuming at least no decrease in the level of programs and no decline in standards, there are some more specific things which are important to our pursuit of excellence. To these we now turn. The design of the total library program can be considered the most fundamental effort in the pursuit of excellence, as I stated earlier, only because it includes the planning which should undergird the orderly growth of the book collection. For certainly the book collection is the essence of a library, and the careful, systematic planning of it is a task exceeded neither in magnitude nor importance by any other in the library. In this discussion, I am, for convenience, using the term book collection broadly in a somewhat generic sense. As such, it includes books, journals, microfilms, microcards, or other medium for the preservation and communication of information. I am not at this point primarily concerned with the medium or form of the material. Earlier, I spoke of our collection as rather remarkable in size and quality for so young a school. Assuming this is true, our goal must be to remove the qualifying phrase. We must strive to build a collection which is excellent for our specific situation in terms of a library program designed to meet specific educational objectives. We must develop a more systematic and vigorous acquisitions program. By systematic, I mean that selection and purchase of materials would be based upon planning, which would include such factors as the following. Decisions as to the scope and depth of collecting needed in very specific subject areas because of a recognized function for the materials in a current or anticipated program or for some other particular reason. Evaluation of the existing collection in these specific subject areas and in light of the earlier decisions on scope and depth, identification of materials which should be sought. Priorities established for the procuring of earlier materials, including periodical backfiles. A realistic appraisal of the significance for us of materials in other libraries. More will be said later regarding this factor. By vigorous acquisitions program, I mean we need to put more money and effort into the building of the collection. If we are ever to purchase the older materials which we need and also keep up with current publications. Actually, our book budget looks quite good, both when considered in relation to the total financial resources of the seminary and when compared with the book budgets of other theological schools. Of 105 ATLA member libraries reporting for 1966-67, the latest year for which statistics are available, only 19 spent more than we did for books. This comparison would be more meaningful, of course, for libraries grouped by school enrollment and size of collection. But it does tell us something about the high priority given the book budget by our seminary. The important thing, however, is to meet our particular needs in order to fulfill the desire for excellence in theological education. Now we turn to the problem of bibliographic control. The difficulties involved in the wise selection of materials and in funding the purchase of them are matched by the problems of knowing of the existence of materials of interest and value to us and of making it probable that material of interest to a particular researcher will be found. We can build our collection systematically, including the decision not to purchase a particular item because it will be available to us from another library, only if we know of the availability of every item of potential value with sufficient bibliographic description to permit evaluation. We can realize the potential value from the materials which are available in our library or elsewhere only if we are able to provide bibliographic tools which are much more effective than existing card catalogs, periodical indexes, and union catalogs. It is imperative that we improve the total area of bibliographic control of our literature, an imperative shared by all theological libraries and indeed by the entire scholarly world. In proposing a system of bibliography for the social sciences and humanities, Eric H. Boehm writes, "The study of man as reflected in the social sciences and humanities is in a serious dissemination crisis." He goes on to list four major facets of this crisis, including the quantity of published literature, which is flooding us, the fact that researchers, scholars are having such a difficult time in keeping up in their own field, the language barrier, which, as he says, has provided a condition analogous to the Tower of Babel, and a significant point, I think, time acts as a diluting factor. After 20 or 30 years, a new generation has only a limited awareness of the work done by a previous generation. Too frequently, the familiar old is rehashed and few genuine advances are made. Boehm goes on to present six recommendations, the first of which would provide for creation of, quote, one integrated, comprehensive, international bibliographic system for the social sciences and humanities, end of quotation. Of course, such a system would necessarily incorporate modern computer technology. Perhaps the interests of theological education could be sufficiently represented in such a project to ensure that it would meet our needs in the humanities and social sciences. But our theological disciplines would not be included, and according to existing patterns in bibliography. And at present, there is little concerted effort among theological librarians to develop an approach. The one big ATLA project in this whole area is the Index to Religious Periodical Literature, which is indispensable but limited due to the coverage of the literature only since 1949 and by its dependence on methodology involving only minimal mechanization. Notable gains have been made, of course, in other fields in controlling the literature. In order for theological libraries to make similar progress, the ATLA Committee on K-12 cataloging and classification, on cataloging and classification, says in its 1967 report, they must consolidate their efforts and their funds to produce a single bibliographical listing comprised of data for all types of materials, monographs, serials, theses, and dissertations, manuscripts, microforms, audiovisuals, which will have international scope and utility. From this source, local cataloging data would be drawn or verified to produce an adequate finding list of whatever depth the library might desire or be able to afford. End of quotation. Such a project should certainly be thoroughly investigated. And perhaps would merit foundation support. Meanwhile, until such comprehensive efforts are forthcoming, we shall bring creativity and hard work to bear on the problem of bibliographic control of information in all phases of our own library operations. I like to think of the library as the teaching partner of the faculty. This is partly a fact and partly an ideal. I believe that the pursuit of excellence requires that we seek to combine the staff, physical facilities, and resource materials of the library so as to fully develop a teaching partnership with each member of the faculty. Let me explain what I mean. Every member of this faculty is committed to academic excellence in theological education. Thus, he seeks to teach rather than train, to stimulate and guide the student in his own search for understanding rather than to indoctrinate him. He desires free and independent inquiry and knows that he has perhaps done his best teaching when a student eagerly rushes from his classroom to the library in order to pursue a stimulating point raised in his lecture or discussion. The teaching-learning process continues in the library. The library is involved in the professor's total concept of his teaching. My concern is that the library be not just passively involved, but be an active teaching partner of the professor. In the first place, this partnership would be manifested by the library in the role of a servant. The library seeks to serve the curriculum of the school. We need to understand the objectives and characteristics of each program of study, to know something of the content, emphases, and requirements of the courses, to be cognizant of anticipated course offerings. All of these in order that our acquisitions, our cataloging, and our circulation and reference work may be perceptively directed toward maximum service to the curriculum. The library also seeks to serve the individual teacher. We would like to work more closely with him to make the library as helpful as possible, both in the teaching of his courses and in his research efforts. We can do more.